Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 14 of the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. This episode is with the fascinating Julia Narden, who conceived and wrote this piece called Dump Site for Seattle Immersive Theater. The show opens April 30th, and it runs through June 7th at an undisclosed warehouse space in SoTo. So what happens is you go to seattleimmersivetheater.org, you purchase your tickets, and then a week ahead of your showtime, you will get the directions to the warehouse. There's going to be a pop-up speakeasy with craft cocktails that opens 45 minutes before each performance. And each performance is only open to about 17 audience members. So it's a great, unique piece of theater that you're going to be able to go to with friends. Very intimate kind of experience. So it was a fascinating interview. Julia is incredibly eloquent and passionate person and theater artist. And so I can't wait for you to listen to that interview. But before we get to that, I really want to give a huge shout out to a new friend of mine, Hannah Schnabel, who's really helping with the costumes for the current show that I'm working on, In the Next Room or the Vibrator Play. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about Hannah and her training. And if you have a specialty costume or project that you need a really talented designer for, I sincerely hope that you will consider Hannah, because she's just been absolutely delightful to work with and a real miracle worker. So let's talk about Hannah for a little bit, okay? All right. So Hannah Schnabel is a Seattle costume designer for film and stage that is making the transition into fashion with the launch of a mini collection in June. This collection is the culmination of 3 years of school through the Seattle Central College's Apparel Design and Development Program, which is reputed as one of the most technically oriented design program in the region and a center of innovative and creative learning. You can learn more about that program at www.seattlecentral.edu/programs/apparel. Hannah's collection is unique as it is designed for the plus size ladies who want to have luxury clothing with beautiful details. Her garments are fully lined and made of silk and cotton blends with custom leather pieces for which she has designed a laser cut pattern. Stretch fabrics are nowhere to be seen in her clothing, so she keeps a watchful eye to the fit of garments to embrace the curves of a full figure. Finally, ladies, am I right? Her sample size is a shapely 18. Hannah has named her collection Belle Ampleur, which means beautiful scale. She believes that beauty is innate in each woman and is not dependent on numbers or a scale or the size one wears. And she wanted to offer something to women who have been marginalized in society because they do not meet the standard set. She wants to celebrate breasts and hips and tummies and all the glorious bits that most people want to hide and flatten into clothing. This collection is just a small sample of the garments she wants to create. After graduation, Hannah would like to be able to develop her line into a fully viable business. Hannah is looking for backers through crowdfunding. She has a GoFundMe campaign set up, which I will link to in the episode description. The donations she has received so far have covered a portion of the cost of making the garments for her line. She would love to be able to continue this collection and is looking to purchase her own professional equipment and begin the process of creating more garments for Belle Ampleur. Her mini collection will be available for viewing June 16th from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Seattle Central College and is open to the public for free. So you should come and see what she's working on. Really awesome clothes for plus size ladies. That's what I'm all about. That's what I'm looking for. And maybe you are too. In addition to her clothing line, Hannah has most recently designed costumes for a web series entitled Manic Pixie Dream Wife, which was written and directed by another local artist, M. Elizabeth Eller. This web series was filmed here in Seattle. Yeah. And has been accepted into the Seattle True Independent Film Festival. The series goes live on YouTube this week. I'll put more information about the web series in the episode description, and the tagline from their Facebook page gives you a good idea what this little romantic dramedy is all about. Manic Pixie Dream Wife is a comic web series exploring the marriage and adventures of Chance and Simone. Witness what happens when planning and stability meet quirk and unpredictability. So I just ask you to keep your eyes on Hannah's work. You might find it in the most unusual of places. And please support her dreams of making clothing for women of beautiful scale a reality. So lots and lots of love to Hannah Schnabel. And so now, on to the interview with the wonderful, eloquent, articulate Julia Narden. Welcome, everyone, to the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm honored to have Julia Narden here. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you here. You are working right now on a play that you wrote for the Seattle Immersive Theater called Dumpsite.
That's right, I am.
And so let's talk a little bit about your origin story as an artist. You studied writing at University of Victoria.
That's right, I did. I was an English creative writing double major. And in my last year, I realized the creative writing program was so impacted that there was no way I was going to graduate on time. So I just dropped the creative writing major and graduated with a focus on English and then a minor in film studies. Maybe not the smartest decision I could have made at the time, but it felt right. So, yeah.
And sometimes when you were studying there, you would take the ferry into Seattle for the night.
I did. I would take weekend trips to Seattle through the Clipper, which I love. And we would come out here and we'd rent a hotel or we'd rent a B&B and we'd go see shows at the Rep or we'd see them at ACT. And then we'd go back to Victoria and lament how uncool Victoria was compared to how wonderful Seattle was. So it was kind of just an easy decision to move back here after I had tried Southern California and it didn't work out very well. So that's kind of what brought me back up.
Right. What was that experience? You were in San Diego, right?
I did. I lived a couple years down in San Diego. I had some friends there. I had a partner there. And I took a bunch of college courses down there after I'd graduated just to get kind of a Meisner focus on the acting.
Sure.
I took a bunch of directing classes. And it just wasn't panning out. The theater scene wasn't what I wanted it to be. And I kept thinking about Seattle and I kept thinking about the Pacific Northwest and how much I loved how it was green all year round and
right.
how it would rain all the time. And I love the rain. So I ended up selling probably 90% of my possessions. I packed the remaining 10% into my car, and then I just drove up here. And I was lucky enough that this woman up on Capitol Hill was subleasing her apartment for 3 months while she was in Costa Rica. So I just leased that. And right out of the gates, I got an internship at ACT and made some connections there. And I've just been here for about 3 years now.
What department were you interning in?
I was working in the development department, which is the fundraising focus.
So you had a production of a show last year that you'd written that featured our good friend Tom Stewart.
We love you, Tom Stewart.
And it was called Starling. Can you talk a little bit about where that project came from?
Yeah. So Starling is a historical piece. It's a drama that focuses on the role that female resistance fighters played in the Warsaw Uprising in Poland. And that was a project that I'd started with a really good friend of mine from college named Sam Murphy. And now she lives in New Zealand in Wellington. So we had this long distance collaboration through Google Docs where I'd write some and she'd write some. And
sure.
We'd edit each other's writing and be like, no, your character voice is wrong. And but we ended up with about a 2.5 hour play. And I brought that to Beau Pritchard, who's the artistic director of the Confrontational Theater Project here in Seattle, and he wanted to put it on. And we went to the Satori Group, and they agreed to lend us their space, and we put it on last June. That sounds right. I think it was June 7th through June 21st. We had Tom Stewart, who you know, and Catherine Jett and Danica Gollenbeck. And it was just a really wonderful experience. And from there, Paul Thomas, who's the artistic director of Seattle Immersive Theater and a friend of mine who I took some Meisner classes with up at the Gilmore Acting Studio in Ballard, which I recommend to anyone who wants an introduction to the Meisner work. Greg Gilmore is fantastic, and he's a no bullshit teacher. Like, he'll put you through your paces.
Sure.
We'd done some work together, and he came to see my show at the Satori space, and he and his wife took me out for drinks after and said, you know, we're starting this theater company, we'd really like it if we could commission you for a piece. And I said, I would love that. Like, it's every playwright's dream to be commissioned for
right.
something, never mind when you're under 30 and being commissioned for something. So I said yes, and that's kind of how Dumpsite came about.
And initially, you were looking at a space that was an abandoned bank.
Yes. It used to be a bank. It was in West Seattle, and I wish I could remember the cross streets. But Paul had identified this bank, and we wanted to do a bank robbery play where, you'd walk in and it'd be a group of maybe 20 people. You'd go about your business as though you were at the bank, and then bank robbers would come in, and it would be kind of a Reservoir Dogs story playing out. And we would have had, you know, film police cruisers in the out, you know, in the parking lot outside. That space fell through. So Paul said to me, look, like, why don't you just write a story that you've had on the back burner? And I said, okay, I've got this one that's kind of, how did I pitch it? It was The Killing Meets Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And he said, do it.
Wow.
Do it. And I said, it can be adapted to any space. So he found the space and I wrote the script. And that was probably about an 8-month process altogether, I think.
And I know some of the mystique and exciting part about this play is that not all of it is revealed before you attend, but can you tell us a little bit about the play?
So it's about this writer from the Pacific Northwest who writes really bad horror fiction, and his father has just passed away, and he's in his father's storage facility because the father was a property manager, going through his late father's belongings, avoiding the process of planning his father's funeral. And he uncovers some old home movies. And when he and his sister put those movies into the VCR, they find out that their father was not necessarily the person that they thought he was. And it turns into this interactive murder investigation where the audience is invited along with Charlotte, who's the sister, and Reed, who's the writer, to kind of uncover what was going on and figure out whether or not their father really did murder some people back in the early 80s when they were children. And it's one of those productions where you really get what you put in. So there's a lot that's going on under the surface. You get to go through drawers and boxes and maybe read journals and find out stuff that's not mentioned in dialogue. It's a really interactive experience, absolutely, yeah.
Wow, and so the audience comes and they have to this place where you don't know where it is until you
I can say what neighborhood it's in because I don't want people to think they're driving up to Burien or something. It's in Soto. It's really accessible. You can take the light rail. It's a block from the light rail. So what happens is you come in, and then we've built this pop-up speakeasy inside the warehouse. So you'll come in. You can get drinks. We have 3 craft cocktails that a bartender at the Hilton, whose name is Jesse Glick, he's fantastic, has designed just for us. Speakeasies open, I think, 45 minutes before the show starts, maybe an hour before the show starts. So you can bring some friends, have a drink, and then you kind of go into the space. You're going to get a rundown from our guide, so you're not left wondering, what can I do, what can't I do? But there are certain times where you're going to be 2 feet away from the actors, maybe less, depending.
And another way that this production is different than a traditional production where you're sitting in a seat in a theater is that each production is limited to only 17 to 20 audience members.
That's right. So if you bring 5 friends, that's a considerable percentage of the audience is people you know, which we really wanted to do. I love the big spaces in Seattle. The rep is great. Act is wonderful. But there's a certain kind of intimacy that you get from a 20-person performance that you can't have in a space that large. Especially when it's interactive like this, where you could, if you wanted to, reach out and touch the actor. We don't encourage people to do that. In fact, we ask them not to do that because it would really... Please don't touch the actors, even though you may want to. But there's just something about when you take away that fourth wall and you take away the safety that you get from a stage, the separation between your actors and your audience, something dangerous and fun happens there. And that's kind of what we wanted to capture. That's kind of what Seattle Immersive Theater is about.
What attracts you as a theater artist to creating a piece that is this a little more dangerous, certainly more vulnerable, more intimate? What is it that gets you excited about creating work like this?
That's such a loaded question. For me, the reason I write for theater and not for film is that it's very immediate in ways that film is not. Film can do a lot that theater can't, but I think theater can do more that film can't. And when you're in a 400-seat house, that's fine. It's wonderful. It's lovely. You can do a great production of something with a 400-seat house. But when you get real close and you can hear someone's breathing and you can see their heart, what it does to their skin, what it does to the veins that you can see in their face or on their neck, like being able to be that close, like there's something tangible about that. So for me, writing plays that tap into that, that visceral element of human nature, if you will, like that's what attracts me to projects like this, is I want to write stories that people can kind of stick their foot in, like you would into a river with your toes, kind of testing the temperature.
Sure.
Like that would be my philosophy, is I really want to grab people in and pull them under the water and let them breathe it and become fish.
You're empowering them to be an active participant.
That's right. That's right.
To be just a lump watching this.
Mm-hmm.
You need to participate. This is really exciting. So you open April 30th.
Mm-hmm.
And the piece is directed by Jen Hammond.
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit about why was she chosen for this project?
Well, Paul gave me, he said, whatever director you want, approach whatever director you want. And I'd seen a show that Jen Hammond put on at Velocity with Ana Maria Campoy called Gifts of War. And she just did this fantastic collaboration between dance. So it was half dance, half theater. So it was a 40-minute script about, with like dance interspersed into this story. And it was really beautiful. And Ana Maria, who's a really good friend of mine, said, you want to work with Jen Hammond. Like, she's incredible. She's a teacher at Freehold. She just knows what she's doing. So I approached Jen, and Jen was on board. And we've kind of just been collaborating ever since. She read a partial version of the script and said, I love it. I want to see more. Let's do this. And that was the start of our collaboration, and we've kind of been working together ever since.
That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And you were involved in the casting process. It's a three-person play.
It's a three-person play. You know, it's such a gift as a playwright to be in the room, not just rehearsal, but in the casting room as well, and to give input. I defer to Jen in everything. As a playwright, you're building the foundation. Your director and scenic designer and lighting designer and everyone else involved in the project, including the actors, builds the structure upon the foundation that you laid. And at some point, you just have to step back and let them do what they're going to do. So I defer to them on everything. They involve me in the process. They ask me questions. I voice my opinion, and either they take it or they don't. It's just, I'm fortunate enough to be involved as much as I am.
Let's talk about this. The cast is exciting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I love Evelyn. I've seen her in Chaos Theory.
Mm-hmm.
She's just very talented. And also Balconies, both at Annex Theater.
Yes.
And then we also have Simon Hamlin.
Mm-hmm.
And Rebecca Burrows.
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit about what the rehearsal process has been
like? Yeah, so we had, I came to them with a finished script by the time that we were doing auditions. And then we really wanted to fine-tune that script based on what our actors needed. So we brought Evelyn and Simon and Rebecca in, and we said, here's the script, let's do a table read, what do you want changed? And I'd already workshopped the script a couple times. It was in its third or fourth incarnation at that point. But they brought all this information to the table and feelings about it and their character arcs that I hadn't even considered. So I went back and I rewrote. And it was getting to the point where I would rewrite the script over a period of 48 hours and I'd bring it back. And they'd be like, no, these changes are wrong. Send it back. And I'd be like, okay, guys. And I'd go back and I'd be up all night and I'd come back the next day with another script and be like, this is better. So I think it was three or four rewrites between the casting process and then the finalized version, which we're working with for this show. They have such a high standard, and that's a blessing, too. As a writer, you don't want to work with people who just say, this is great, let's put it on as it is. You really want them to pick it apart so everyone's doing the best that they can do.
Absolutely. So what other projects are you sort of are in process for you right now that you can talk about?
Yeah, I can talk about. That's really tricky. I'm writing a series of monologues for a friend of mine on the hero's journey from a female perspective that's being pitched to a couple theaters. They're going to do a devised piece around those 10 monologues, and each monologue corresponds to a, how do I put this? The director's calling them female spirit guides, but they're really these women from history who influence the world in which they were born. So without getting into who they are, because I don't want to spoil anything,
There's
10 really strong, wonderful women. I would say maybe 75% are people that are familiar. If you were to hear their names, you'd be like, I know who that is. And then the other ones are kind of obscure. So I'm working on that right now. And then the other one that I'm working on is the book for a musical. And we're shopping that around. I'm shopping that around with a friend of mine. And that's my next 2016, 2017. And that musical is also going to be a historical World War II era piece set in France in a brothel. And that's as deep as I can get into that one. But it's going to incorporate burlesque. We're reaching out to the burlesque community and having it be like a full-on play, musical, burlesque, maybe some vaudeville if we can get it, and have it be a real theatrical experience that people can come and see, whether they're tourists or Seattle natives. And
fantastic.
We're really excited. Yeah. I feel like I've given too much away, but...
Can you give us some insight into your writing process? Is it sort of the same time, same space every day, or does inspiration strike at different moments?
God, I am one of those people who I can't write at home. Like, I procrastinate, and I will rearrange furniture. I'll shop online on Etsy for stuff that I don't need, just not to write. I do most of my writing at coffee shops around town, just because that's when I get it done. If I'm at home, it just doesn't seem to happen. I'll find excuses not to do it. Usually I'll sit down for 4 or 5 hours at a stretch. I won't do it in little bursts. It has to be long periods of time where I'm sitting in front of a computer or sitting in front of a journal, really just writing stuff down, and then I'll go back and edit it later. In terms of coming up with ideas, I usually have 4 or 5 in the back of my mind that I'm working on, and then I'll pair it with who wants to work with me, and then we'll pick one from the pot and just kind of pluck it out and turn it into a project that we both want to work on.
Do you find that an important part of your process, sort of knowing who you're collaborating with?
Absolutely.
That helps it
come
to life.
That's very true. Because as a playwright, if you're not directing it and you're not acting in it, you have to really reach out to someone who wants to work with you. And then you have to find out why they want to work with you. What is it about your aesthetic that appeals to them? And then you kind of match your aesthetic to their aesthetic and find the best idea that you have floating around in your brain that you think would really gel. And that's been my experience anyway.
What do you look for in artistic collaboration? What are the things that really turn you on as a playwright?
People who don't give easy answers, like people who give me shit when I talk to them. Honestly, one of the people that I'm most excited to be working with over the next couple of years is Emily Pennock, who's the associate artist at ACT right now. And she's just incredible. Like, she's a powerhouse. She's one of those women who in 10 years is probably going to be the artistic director of her own company or one of the pre-existing companies in the region or somewhere else in the country, depending on where she lands. But she's just incredible. She asks you the right questions. She gets you thinking down paths that you wouldn't necessarily go down because you're not that person, but she is. She actually played a very large role in helping me workshop this one before I took it to Paul and before I took it to Jin. She arranged a reading in her apartment, and we brought some people in. And Rachel Del Mar was one of those. You had a chat with Rachel Del Mar the other week. She sat down with me, and we worked through it, and they gave me some feedback and asked some questions that I hadn't really anticipated. So that's kind of where I'm at there with artistic collaborations. I like those questions. I like being challenged. I like thinking about things ways that I necessarily would not have thought about them myself. Just being attracted to polar opposites, I think, is the direction I end up getting drawn toward. Writing a musical is something I never thought I would ever do because I'm not musically inclined. I started taking piano when I was 5 or 6 and I quit. And I tried clarinet in high school and I quit that. And I'm just a disaster when it comes to music. So I'm really excited to be working on a musical, even though I won't be working on the musical component.
That project sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Would you say in your process as a writer, there comes a point where you know that you need to hear it out loud? Is that workshopping part of your process, would you say?
I would say when I'm 80% there, I need to hear it out loud. Because usually once you hear it out loud, you realize that most of it's not working. And then you have to go back through the script and kill your darlings, as we like to call it. No matter how attached you are to something, if it's not working, you have to get rid of it. Which is why that feedback and workshopping process is so important. That's not true. You can workshop too much. But I would say every script needs to be workshopped at least once or twice. And then you go back through and you make the changes based on... You don't have to take every piece of advice, but you should really listen to it and really decide whether or not you're speaking truth. Because I think as playwrights, a lot of the time we're trying to fill pages and we're not speaking truth. And there's a bullshit detector. And if you have the right people in the room that have that, they can say, hey, what you're writing is trying too hard, or it's not on point, or you're writing around an idea, you're not writing around characters. Just little things like that. And, you know, we can get into the nitty-gritty too. That's important, whether or not a line of dialogue is working or if you need to rephrase it. That's a smaller example. But in terms of your arc and the ideas and the themes that you're writing around, you want to make sure that what you're doing has weight that people can connect to. Because if you throw an anchor in the water and it doesn't sink, what good is it?
How do you find those artists with good bullshit meters?
It's trial and error. I mean, every artist that I've met here in Seattle, and I know that there's this Seattle freeze mentality because we're such a Nordic city here with all those Norwegian ancestors, and there's just that kind of, you know, polite guardedness that they have in those countries. But everyone here has just been so welcoming and friendly. Honestly, I can't think of a single person I run into in this community who has not genuinely wanted to have everyone that they interact with be the very best that they can be. So finding someone who's willing to be mean, maybe mean's the wrong word, but to be honest in the most critical, constructive, the yes. most constructive way possible, that's a challenge. I think it's just trial and error when you talk to someone about what you're working on and you listen to the way that they critique their own work. I find that people who are more willing to say that the stuff they're working on is not perfect, they're the people that you want to work with because you know that they're not going to blow smoke up your ass.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. What advice would you give to aspiring playwrights?
Produce your own work, honestly. In this process, like, I did all the marketing for Starling. I hired a photographer who's incredible, by the way. If anyone is looking to hire a photographer in Seattle, Daniel Barnum is the one you want to hire. So I talked to Danielle about the marketing materials. I did all the press releases myself. I had a very good friend of mine who I met when I moved here teach me how to write a press release. And yeah, self-produce. Don't direct your show. Don't necessarily act in your show, but really go out there, find people you want to work with and say, look, I am willing to do whatever it takes to get this done. Like, I will market it. I will talk to the press. I will go to the print shop and spend my own money on these posters to get it done. Self-produce in that sense and find a team of people that you really want to work with. Write a show for an actor that you really like. Don't just sit back and be passive. Don't submit your scripts to theaters you know, on the other side of the country. It's like scattershot. At that point, you want to build connections locally, and then you want to pursue those connections at a very intimate, very personable level. That would be my advice.
I'm reminded a little bit of an interview that I heard recently with Christian Schaal mm-hmm. about The Daily Show and about how Jon Stewart really has his finger in all of the pots and mm-hmm. every single joke. He's writing, rewriting between the table read and when it goes live, and that sort of what you were saying sort of reminded me of that, of having your artistic investment in as many aspects of the production as possible.
Self-producing is definitely the way to go. I think it's easier when you're writing cabaret or musicals or doing burlesque. A lot of people in town do that, and they do a really good job self-producing. For a playwright especially, most playwrights I know, myself included, are a little bit shy. We're pretty introverted. We spend a lot of time daydreaming and mm-hmm. focus our energy inward instead of outward. So it can kind of be very difficult to reach out to people and say, look, I wrote this thing. I'd really like it if we put it on. But once you find that inside yourself and really feel confident about your own work and find those partnerships that you want to pursue and develop and maintain over the next decade or two decades or however long you're going to be working in a specific place, just nourish that and be proud of what you've written and take ownership. I think that's the word we're really looking at here, is ownership.
Are there topics, other than the projects that you mentioned before, what's sort of on your artistic bucket list?
Oh, on my bucket list. Well, Dumpsite is kind of my love letter to the Pacific Northwest, in a sense. There's a lot about nature in there. It's a play about birds. And it's just, there's something about this region in which we live that is not only beautiful, but there's something kind of sinister and dark about it, too. So I kind of wanted to write a play about that, and now I've crossed that off my bucket list. just a matter of where I want to go next. Let me think. So I've got the World War II brothel musical piece that I'm working on. I've got this set of monologues that I'm working on right now. There's some others. I wanted to do a play set in a funeral home for a really long time about these two people who meet and they're there for funeral and they're both very dishonest about why they're there. I did not know this, but when I was working on researching for Dumpsite, because there's a funeral that takes place during the show, you can hire people to come to your funeral and pretend that they knew you to make it as feel as though more people loved you than they did. That is a profession. I'm not sure how you find those people. I'm still researching that, but they're called placebos. And they come, they're professional mourners. So one character was going to be that, and then the other character was going to be kind of a con artist who swindled family members out of money.
Sure.
And then the play was going to revisit those characters over a series of funerals over the next 10 years and how their relationship kind of is founded in this deception. And it was a play about who are we really? What is a relationship really? It's in its infant stages, so I can't speak much to it. But that was something that I really wanted to do for a while, and that'll probably be my next one after these two get knocked out. And I've had some time to really develop it and think about it. I'm not sure if it's a two-person play or more than that. If I work with Seattle Immersive again, I would love to do it in an actual funeral home.
Right?
They have a very specific smell. And it's not a bad smell, but it's a very clinical, almost.
Absolutely. It's the formaldehyde, right?
It's the formaldehyde. They keep everything meticulously clean. There's that underlying floral bouquet scent. There's so much about the funeral industry that's so interesting that I wanted to weave into. I think that's definitely kind of on my bucket list, though I should probably stop writing about death or my friends are going to think there's something seriously wrong with me.
Sort of going back to what you were saying about this region has this lush greenness and this beauty paired with, I think you're absolutely right, with this sort of sinister underneath. I do think that that's why artists and theater makers and writers are drawn there. Do you think there's something that feeds?
There was a beautiful series of photographs called, oh, I wish I could remember off the top of my head what it was called. I did an interview with the Examiner the other week and I talked about it. It was a text interview, so I was able to look up the name of the series. But what it was this beautiful series of photographs by a local photographer where he looked up where these murder victims had been discarded by their murderers. And he went and he took pictures of those sites 10, 20, 30 years after the bodies had been discarded there. And they were almost all exclusively these beautiful wilderness locations, like a quiet meadow.
Right.
With flowers blooming and canopies creating these shaded areas, or a beach, or a playground with one of those balls that attach to a string. What are those called that you... Whatever they're called.
Oh my gosh, we're doing the motion. It's, tetherball.
Tetherball. So like a tetherball and weeds and wildflowers growing with pavement kind of edging into that. And they were just these beautiful, serene. But when you think about the history of violence connected with that, there was just this terrifying juxtaposition that kind of struck me to my core when I was looking at those. And I think that like ties back into it too. Absolutely. Most of the serial killers in the United States come from the Pacific Northwest. They may not kill here, but they were either born here or they worked here at some point. And I would really like to know why. Like, what is it about this region that breeds that sort of mentality? Because I think for the most part, we're a very friendly, very polite, if a little standoffish, genuinely wanting, you know, the best for everybody. But what is that about that 0.001% of the population that takes this dark turn and starts heading down that shadowy, thickety, weeded path?
That's fascinating. I just got goosebumps right now. As we're sort of winding down our time together, we want to remind people to please go see Dumpsite, opening April 30th. This is truly a unique theatrical experience that you're not going to want to miss. Bring some of your friends. And the best way to get tickets is to email info@seattleimmersivetheater.org. And that's theater spelled R-E, not the other way. It's the way I prefer.
It's the way I prefer it as well.
So, Julia, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was lovely to talk to you and get insight into your process.
Well, thank you for having me, Katie. I really appreciate it.